You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hi, and welcome to Connect the Dots. I am your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today on this beautiful Thursday in Lent where the sun has been seen for the first time in, I think, since October. I'm not sure, out here in Washington, and so I'm happy. And we're here today with Deacon Stephen Greidonis to talk about life, the universe, and everything as we do here at this hour every day, Monday through Friday. How you doing, Deacon Steve?
I'm good. How are you?
Or Deek, as I'm sure, you know, you're used to being called by your rough,
you know,
flock.
So far in my experience, Deek is one of those things like New Jersey. See, people say New Jersey, and as a native of my state, I always have to explain to them that, you know, how there are different regional pronunciations. You know, the rest of the country says Missouri, but if you're actually from there, you say Missouri. Everyone else says New Orleans, but if you actually come from there, you have to say Nawlins. And I do understand that the rest of the country says Jersey, but strange as it seems, if you're actually from here, we say Jersey. It's just one of those quirky things of the language.
Yeah. Well, you know, and no one in Washington says Washington. Nobody.
Yeah.
In fact, I think that there's actually a law in the books that you can be exiled if you do say Washington when you're actually a citizen here. I'm not sure, but I think that that's the case. Well, anyway, cool. We've been it's been a busy week here. I was mentioning before we went on the air, I started writing this article, and it's just kind of taken over my life now, and it's almost 5,000 words long, which means that no one will publish it because it's too big. However, I have strategies for dealing with that, so I'm actually going to go through and kind of dice the article up and publish it as a series for Catholic Weekly. But it's still like not done yet. And it's taking over my life, Steve. And I'm wondering, as as somebody who gives spiritual guidance, what do I do? How can I keep this article from completely taking over my life? Is there a strategy that you would recommend? It's like a prayer, fasting, and almsgiving thing, or what?
I'm all in favor of prayer, fasting, and almsgiving, but the only solution that I found to the problem of the thing that you want to write about that metastasizes and takes over your life is either abandon it completely and give up in despair, or just keep writing.
Well, okay, I'm going to go with the I've come too far already. This was how this is one of the ways that they kept World War I going. Was that after they reached a certain number of millions dead in World War I, the reasoning became, we can't stop now or all those people who died will have died for nothing. So we have to keep going. I'm going to take that approach with my article, I think. I've killed too many electrons. Yes, I've killed too many electrons already. I just have to go on until I've killed the last one. So that's what I'm going to do. So what's new? What's shaking?
The movie news this week is the upcoming and in fact opening tonight version of Ghost in the Shell, which is a very well-regarded anime. I have some exposure to it, but I haven't really seen it much at all. Okay. The live-action remake stars Scarlett Johansson, and there's a lot of controversy around whitewashing about this product of the Asian world, this anime that's been cast with an American superstar.
What's wrong with Lucy Liu? I mean, you know, why couldn't they have gone with her?
That's a very valid question. However, there was a screening of Ghost in the Shell last night, and instead of going to see it, I chose to introduce two of my children to Selma. Ava DuVernay, Selma, starring David Oyelowo. So, and we've already talked about Selma, and I'm not going to talk about Ghost in the Shell, so I haven't seen it. So we're going to have to find something else to talk about.
Okay. I think we can do that.
Yes.
Do you, in fact, have any other things you want to talk about? Is there, for example, something in the news that you were interested in discussing?
Well, I do have to say that I was much struck and even a little disoriented this morning. As a person who kind of prides myself on trying to learn to talk to everyone, to speak everybody's language, and potentially to help translate from one person to another. And I try to be comfortable with as many different kinds of people as I can. And every once in a while, something throws me a little. And I have to say that I was a little bit thrown by just how violent and shocked and outraged and disgusted some of the reaction was to the revelation that Vice President Mike Pence has a longstanding policy of not eating one-on-one with a woman who is not his wife, and of not socializing with people where there's alcohol being served unless his wife is with him. And this has been it's been met. You think he might as well have said that he insists that his wife wear a full burqa and that she not be allowed to drive. And, you know, and even that would be somewhat less outrageous than what he's actually done here. And so I thought that that was very interesting. And then on the other hand, of course, you have all of these people who apparently have never talked to each other. They don't live in the same zip codes and they don't go to the same parties. You have this whole host of other people who are like, yeah, that's how you protect your marriage. I mean, this is pretty common sense stuff. Uh-huh. Only in the age of liberal insanity could anyone possibly think that there would be any problems with this whatsoever. And
right.
So that's,
you know, this is one of those. I mean, it's probably not like a huge secret that I am not the number one fan of the Trump administration. I think it's gotten out. I think it's leaked out that I'm not keen on the Trump administration. But, you know,
I should say that while I am not quite as outspoken as you on that subject, it doesn't dominate my Facebook feed quite the way that it does yours. But nevertheless, I also nothing but opposed to the Trump administration.
Not a fan. Yet, for all of that, you know, this is one of those stories where I'm like, who cares? You know, I just cannot care about something like this. Why, of all the things in the world to be upset about, this just does not seem to be way up at the top for me. I mean, I could see disagreeing, you know, and I could see real arguments for disagreeing.
So, let's consider some of those real arguments, because I think that, you know, it's one thing for us. Here we are. We're two guys and we're both saying that this guy's behavior is no big deal. But there are some people who are concerned about this, and not everyone falls into the frothing at the mouth.
Right.
This is literally the worst thing that has ever happened. There are some feminists and feminist supporters who are men who are raising some valid concerns about this kind of behavior
and
from the Vice President of the United States. So let's talk about that.
Well, I think there's a couple of things. My first thought about it when I read the story was, okay, I can see his point. On the other hand, I would not hesitate for one second, and have in fact done that multiple times. I wouldn't hesitate for one second to go to lunch with or go to dinner with some woman who is not Jen. But there's a reason for that. And the reason for that is it would never remotely occur to me to be tempted to anything untoward in that. I would go to lunch or dinner, and I have gone to lunch and dinner with women that are not Jan by myself, because we had whatever it was we needed to talk about, and that was a convenient way to do it. And then we had lunch, or then we had dinner, and then I came home. And that was all, and there was nothing to worry about. And so that's one problem, is it suggests, you know, my question is, why do you think that would be a problem, Mr. Pence. I mean, what are you worried about? And I think that that's a legitimate argument. But more than that, of course, and this is the primary objection that I've heard from women who are professionals, is that cuts us out of an awful lot of access to the Vice President of the United States.
Yes.
For professional reasons.
Right. So that is something to bear in mind. And for listeners who are more on the sympathetic toward Mike Pence side of the equation, you know, I think it's important to recognize that, and this has been called the Billy Graham rule, because a version of this rule was formulated by Billy Graham, and not just for himself, but for his missionaries. And he had a particular concern because he was sending people on the road, you know, sending out men to go and evangelize who were going to be, you know, away from their wives for extended periods of time. And, you know, in the business world, there's even there's something of a cliche about the business travel affair, you know, that you're away from home and the normal rules don't apply. But all of that being said, I think everyone should be able to understand that this kind of scruple can very easily be taken to an exaggerated extreme. And I'll give you an example. Many of the people who were the first to speak out in favor of the Billy Graham rule said they wouldn't even take an elevator because a woman might get on. They always take the stairs.
Right. Yeah. Well, we'll continue this when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Deacon Stephen Gardanus. And we're talking about the Mike Pence rule. And we'll be back on Redbox Media right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hello, and welcome to Connect the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We are here today with Deacon Stephen Gardanus. We've been talking about the news story that came out today that Mike Pence has had a longstanding rule. He's our vice president, in case you don't know, has had a longstanding rule of never meeting with women, even in a public venue.
One-on-one.
What's that?
One-on-one.
Yeah, one-on-one is what I mean. Without if his wife's not there. So no dinners, no one-on-one meetings with women. And as you mentioned in the first segment, there's been this, you know, explosion of outrage about this.
I'd like to give an example of that.
Yeah, sure.
So this is from Paul Waldman at the Washington Post, washingtonpost.com. And he writes, let's just take a moment to consider this pair of rules that Mike Pence has for himself. He obviously thinks that every interaction he has with a woman is so sexually charged that it's only safe to be around them if there are other people there too. Mm-hmm. Unless someone might be drinking, in which case even the presence of a crowd isn't enough to prevent something from happening. Mm-hmm. There's little distance between that perspective and that of the ultra-Orthodox Jews who refuse to sit next to a woman on an airplane, or the fundamentalist Muslims who demand that women be covered head to toe to contain the unstoppable sexual allure that renders men unable to control their urges. Now, this is clearly an over-the-top response.
Right. And yet I want to do two things. First of all,
just as we were getting to the break, I was throwing out an example of how the Billy Graham rule, as it's been called, while it's not in the same league as refusing to sit next to a woman on an airplane or, you know, insisting on you know, that women go the full burqa, the Billy Graham rule in practice has been, in fact, not I've heard, you know, of cases like this myself. Right. It does go sometimes to a too far extreme.
Right.
There are men who are pastors or who are otherwise very scrupulous who, when they are traveling between floors in modern buildings, always take the stairs rather than an elevator. Because if you're on an elevator, you might be alone with a woman.
That does seem a bit scrupulous, actually.
A bit scrupulous. Yeah.
It's like, how slow is that elevator, pal? I mean, come on, you know? Yeah, that seems kind of weird to me. I want to offer one defense of this. It's not a very good defense, I think, but it is that. So, yes, there is something weird about having a rule like that, as though, you know, every interaction with a woman is going to be sexually charged. I think that that's a strange thing. And if that's the reason for the rule, I don't actually know the reason for the rule. But on the other hand, it is the case that it's not unheard of, especially, you know, there's the famous joke that you can't have a nativity play anywhere inside the Beltway because nobody can find three wise men and a virgin in Washington, D.C. And there is the reality because, you know, welcome to the 21st century. There is the reality that politicians can be, and this is what Billy Graham was worried about, too, of course, can be falsely charged with making sexual advances. Rather than the other way around.
That is also, yes.
Yeah. And that is, you know, so that seems to be a sort of keep your powder dry kind of precaution. So I can see how somebody, especially somebody like Pence, who, you know, comes from an evangelical background, although he was raised Catholic, I think, could just be playing it safe. Okay, I get that. And I can see that as a defense. Here's the thing, though. This is something Michelle Arnold, a mutual friend of ours, wrote. I thought it was common sense. She says, "The more I think about it, the more I'm convinced the very definition of male privilege is a guy freely deciding that he won't meet with women in a public venue and not have it adversely affect his career at all."
Right.
And that's, I find that hard to argue with. You know?
It is, you know, and that gets to the point that you were making before, that a world in which men, and particularly men in positions of power, might meet for lunch or for a business dinner one-on-one with another man, but never with another woman. Well, that's going to advantage men in the workplace.
Of course
and,
it is.
You know, the idea of a female president being unwilling or not having a rule against sitting down in a room with another man,
right?
We can't even imagine her functioning in that rule, in that role. And by the same token, it's almost impossible to imagine her even getting to that point. I mean, Mike Pence,
she would never be a female president if she had functioned that way,
right? Because
her, you know,
Mike Pence had to have a lot of one-on-ones with a lot of men to get to be vice president.
Right.
And so, by definition, if he were a woman, he couldn't have done it while following that rule. And therefore, you know, as a man following that rule, he's only going to help other men up the ladder. So that's a legitimate objection.
Right. And to an awful lot of women, it's not terribly surprising. You know, sure. You know, let's say the reason for the rule, and again, I stress, I don't know that we know the reason for the rule. All we know is that the rule exists.
Right. Well, he's said things like, you know, if I'm going to be somewhere where there's drinking and people are getting loose, I want to have the prettiest brunette in the room at my side, and that does give some fodder for the, you know, right. he's worried about getting out of control. And, you know, but
right.
having said that, having said that, let's acknowledge, first of all, that even people who are very much in love with their partners and who have absolutely no intentions of being unfaithful do sometimes get their heads turned by a coworker.
Right. Sure.
You know, people do find themselves, you know, people with the best of intentions, people who are, you know, they become infatuated. They fall in love with the wrong person.
Right. And yeah, it does happen.
And even if you are determined, no matter what, that you are going to be faithful, and that's, you know, that's the line that you're not going to cross, there are a whole bunch of lines before that point that it would be better not to cross, even if you're not going to go across that final line.
Right.
So,
I mean, one of the commenters on Michelle's remark said, and again, hard to argue with, you know, this is a woman writing, and she says it seems a lot like projection to her. And I can't fault a woman for feeling like that. You know, it's like, I just wanted to have lunch because I wanted to talk about this trade bill. And you're having all these weird issues about whether I'm going to, you know, try to seduce you. I mean,
okay.
You know, what's wrong with you, right?
Let's just establish the parameters of the discussion. I think the vast majority of us are going to be able to agree that the guy who takes the stairwell because he's concerned about being on an elevator alone with a woman, this is a person.
That's weird.
he's off the charts in the one direction. Okay.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, if a man and a woman who work for the same company were on a business trip in another city and they were staying at a hotel, they should have separate rooms.
Yes, absolutely.
And it doesn't matter how steadfast they are in their loyalty and their fidelity to their spouses and how determined they could be both. They could be the pinnacles of chastity. And that doesn't mean it's therefore okay to share a hotel room, even if there are separate beds and everything is all, you know, it's nobody should say, well, my spouse can trust me. And it's, so somewhere between these two ridiculous extremes, somewhere in there, there's a line that can reasonably be drawn, or different lines for different people with different cultural backgrounds and different temperaments. And we may have some critical problems with where Mike Pence has chosen to draw the line, but it isn't something as simple as, well, he just thinks that he's, you know, a hunk of burn in love and every woman around him just wants to jump his bones and he wouldn't be able to stop himself. So, you know, I don't think we need to interpret his actions in all that perverse a light to say, yeah, maybe he's been raised in a culture that's a little too scrupulous about these things, and there are some problems that occur, but it doesn't make him like this fireball of misogyny or something.
Right. Sure. Yeah. And I get that. Yeah. Which is why my response to the story was like, okay, this is just doesn't seem worth getting all that worked up about. You know, and I would draw the line in different areas, but it doesn't seem to me to be worth having a cow over. On the other hand, I can understand professional women looking at that and going, that means that I am effectively cut off from access to the president, or to the vice presidents, under a huge range of circumstances that are unfair. And I totally agree with that. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Deacon Stephen Gordonis, and we'll be back on Breadbox Media right after this.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
Oh.
guts.
I'm your host, Mark Shea, and I have uncontrollable giggles, and I'm coughing too, and it's all very confusing. Yesterday, Rod Bennett and I spent some time talking about the Sunday readings, because I was very struck by the Sunday readings. And now I have on my show, within my very grasp, virtually speaking, a deacon who actually preached the homily on the Sunday readings this past Sunday. And so I thought it would be interesting. Picture him, if you will, standing before the congregation, dressed in pink.
Yes.
As
did you see my picture on Facebook?
I did. It was badass.
I posed for that shot specifically for you.
Did you?
I did.
It was pretty badass. I got to say, that was that was great. You know, you almost overcame the fact that you were wearing pink, and that's great. So, I am stunned to discover that you actually studied, took a class on being mocked.
Oh yes,
at seminary, and
yes.
You know, and that's mighty big of you. So
well. I'd already had a lot of experience, so
you're off the hook until Gaudete Sunday now.
Childhood training, actually.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good. That's good. That's good. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what you spoke on this past Sunday, because I'm intrigued.
This was actually the longest homily I ever preached. Suzanne told me that the gospel reading and my homily together, because she taped it on her, she recorded it on her iPhone. She said I was up there in the Ebo for 25 minutes.
Wow.
Yes.
That's really long for a Catholic homily.
Yeah. Well,
and the pews, if you do that.
I didn't get any complaints. One guy came up to me afterward and he told me that I had moved him.
That's fantastic.
Well, so one of the things that struck me is that we're in the middle of a series of gospel readings from the Gospel of John. And because this is year A in the liturgical cycle of readings, most of the readings are from Matthew, the first gospel. But we have the 3 years, A, B, and C, for Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And then John is kind of interspersed among all 3 years. And right now we're in a cycle of Johannine readings. And last week's gospel was the Samaritan woman at the well. And this week it was the man born blind. And next week it will be the raising of Lazarus. And these three readings are smack dab in the middle of Lent, of course, because they're all in their own way pictures of conversion. And what struck me was that each of these individuals was at a very different place in their relationship with God. The Samaritan woman, being a Samaritan, doesn't even really know God the way that the Jewish people do. The man born blind is Jewish, but doesn't yet know Jesus. He's not a disciple of Jesus. Lazarus already knows Jesus. He's already a disciple.
Yeah.
And yet each of them has room in their lives for some kind of conversion, for transformation, for a new experience of God's grace. And this being the gospel of the man born blind, the subjects of light and vision dominate the gospel, not just the gospel, but all of the readings. To the Ephesians, St. Paul's letter to the Ephesians, we read, "You were once darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Live as children of light, for light produces every kind of goodness and righteousness and truth. Take no part of the fruitless works of darkness. Everything exposed by the light becomes visible. Everything that becomes visible is light. Arise, awake, O sleeper, arise from the dead, and Christ will give you light." St. Paul in the Gospels Jesus in the gospel says, "While I am in the world, I am the light of the world." We have to do the works of the one who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. And even in the Old Testament reading, we have when Samuel spots David, the future King David's big brother Eliab, God says to him, "Do not judge by his appearance. Not as man sees does God see, because man sees the appearance, but the Lord looks into the heart."
Yeah.
But you have something you wanted to say about that.
Well, yeah, we were talking about this yesterday. I was very struck by that because, you know, that's kind of, if you will, an expected piety in Judeo-Christian thought, that, you know, what matters is the heart and not how you look. And that, you know, that has been particularly drilled into us by the Christian part of the Judeo-Christian heritage, with, you know, in Christ Jesus, there is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female, red and yellow, black and white, they are precious in his sight. And so that's what we expect. But then what the sacred writer does, and I think he does it with extreme and careful deliberateness, is that when we've run through all of David's big brothers, and Samuel looks around and goes, is that it? Do you have anybody else? Then Jesse says, well, there's David.
And Samuel's like, send for him. We're not going to get started without him.
Whatever. You know, okay, bring him in, right? And then what's really interesting is that what he doesn't do when we introduce David, what the sacred writer does not do is say, he was a pious lad who always sang songs to the Lord. And
a man after God's own heart.
A man after God's own heart. That's not what you get. Instead, what you get was he had a ruddy complexion and a beautiful eyes, and he was incredibly good looking. And you go, that sticks out. This sticks out for a number of reasons. It sticks out because physical descriptions of biblical characters are virtually non-existent.
Virtually non-existent. In fact, the biblical literature, to the extent that it constitutes, if not a genre, at least a milieu, biblical literature is among the least visually descriptive literature in human history.
Right. It's just not interested in that. And so as I said yesterday, you search the length and breadth of the New Testament and you will never find a physical description of the most important human being who ever lived. Right? And that really sticks out then. And the question then becomes, why does the sacred author do that? Especially why does he do that after he's just said looks don't matter?
And so what are your theories about this, Mark?
Well, I think the reason that he does that is precisely to point out that David was invisible.
Wait,
nobody saw David was invisible. Nobody saw him because he's the youngest. He's a shepherd. He didn't matter in that culture because children didn't matter in that culture. Children didn't matter in Jesus's time. That's why the apostles think it's remarkable that Jesus is interested in them. And comment on the fact, you know, response of the apostles to mothers who brought their children to be blessed. Buzz off, get lost, right? Because children didn't matter, because children were invisible. And David is young, and David is a shepherd, which means he has all the social standing of a parking lot attendant in that culture.
Sure.
And so he was invisible. And so nobody saw him. And so what does the sacred author do? The sacred author says, nobody saw this guy, even though he was as good looking as all of his brothers were. That was, you know, that was what Samuel responded to. This Eliab looks like, you know, he's pretty good looking. That's not the guy. And so I think that that's the reason, especially because when you get to, and I think that the church gets this, because the church picks that reading of all the readings they could have picked out of the Old Testament. The church picks that reading, which is all about sight and invisibility and blindness, and then couples it with the story of the man born blind,
sure,
which is, again, all about people not seeing.
Yes.
Yeah.
And all three of these people in these three gospels, they're each insensitive or unable to perceive in very different ways. You know,
right.
the woman at the well she doesn't know the law. She doesn't know the revelation of God to Israel. She doesn't even know that salvation comes from the Jews.
Right.
So, and then the man born blind, he can't see anything. So to him at first, Jesus is, he's just a sir, and then he becomes a prophet, and then he doesn't become the Christ until the end of the story, which is a similar progression that the woman at the well goes through. And then, of course, next Sunday, we're going to hear from Lazarus. Lazarus was dead. And I think it's important to recognize, because you and I, we both come from Protestant backgrounds. And right. I don't know about you, but when I was coming into the church, I resisted the language of saying, I say today very easily, people say, oh, you weren't raised Catholic. I say, no, I'm a convert. But I didn't like the suggestion that I was converting to Catholicism when I was a Protestant, because to me, from my background, conversion, that meant becoming a believer, accepting right. Jesus into your heart as your Lord and Savior. I already had faith. I was already baptized. And right. so it took me a while, even after I become convinced that God was calling me to the Catholic Church, to understand that conversion is not just one and done, that sometimes it's more gradual. Sometimes it's an ongoing process. And I said this in my homily. I've said this here on the radio show. A good homilist is always preaching, or usually preaching, to himself. And so there are things that God wants to continue to convert in me, ways that I haven't yet let him change me. And believe me, after preaching that homily, I've been experiencing that reality.
Very good. Well, you're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis, and we'll be back on Breadbox Media right after this to talk about more very short sequels. Back right after this.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
And welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis. And we are going to revisit something that we talked about last week because it's just super fun. Take it away, Steve.
So last week, I revealed that I have gone back to a Twitter handle that I established in 2012 called Very Short Sequel. You can follow me on Twitter at Very Short Sequel. And my shtick there is very simple. I am inspired by people writing Twitter short fiction. You can write, if you're very clever and inspired, you can write really interesting stories in 140 characters. Sometimes people like to write horror, they like to write comedy, they like to write romance. And what I do is very simple. I come along and I pull the rug out from under the story after it's written. I write a sequel that sometimes reverses the point of the original story, sometimes misinterprets or reinterprets it. Sometimes I extend the story in the same direction. Sometimes I try to redeem a story that was downbeat. Sometimes I bring a story down that was upbeat. I like to go crazy and do all kinds of things. So what we're going to do is Mark is going to read the original story by the other author, and I will read the sequel. And we're going to start out with a story by a guy who's a kind of a overwhelmingly saccharinely fey, whimsical, magic and flowers and dragons and unicorns kind of a guy. He bugs me a little, and so I kind of enjoy poking him a bit, and that's what I did here.
Is this the mermaid one you want me to do?
No. The first one in the email. We'll go to the mermaid one after.
Okay. I now suspect I was born into a traveling troupe of wizards, but then given to ordinary parents when I was too young to protest.
So that's why I hate wizards. Lousy deadbeats? Oh, they might mentor you if you're a special orphan, but ordinary parents rule.
Good. That was subversive.
Yeah, well, I feel like, first of all, you're dissing your parents because they're ordinary and you're romanticizing about your origins. What? These guys gave you up. They're losers.
Good. Let's see.
And I like celebrating the ordinary.
All right. Me too. That's a very Chestertonian thing to do.
Yes.
Gina finally had kids. For once, she felt complete. But after 2 days, she released them, letting them return to their families.
So that's a story that takes a dark turn at the end. watching the kids trot bleating across the field, Gina felt the old sadness return. Someday she must have goats of her own.
Very good.
Yes. Let's do the mermaid one, because the mermaid one is one where I didn't subvert it. It's really in the spirit of the original story. And this is someone who I happen to know is a fan of my work. And I kind of wanted to honor her wishes and the intention and write a story that she would really appreciate in the context of what she wrote.
Okay. The worst thing she decided about being a new mermaid was that she'd never get to wear those cute shoes she just bought.
Her shoes joined a vast heap of mermaid cast-offs on the seabed, becoming homes for fish. Now they're practical, she laughed.
Okay, that's good.
As you can see, you know, you might not necessarily know, but it happens that this particular writer is a woman, and so I thought, you know, the lament of not getting to wear cute shoes. But then there's also this whole thing of like practical shoes and impractical shoes. And I just thought that would be a nice way to make them practical.
I like it. Okay. Here's the next one. All dogs go to heaven, he said. Even the one who killed my son. Sorry. That's the rule. He's probably up there right with him right now. Yikes. Okay. I have a black sense of humor. You might have noticed that.
What about cats? Will I see my cat in heaven? Yes, all cats go to heaven too. But first, they're reincarnated as dogs.
That's good. Oh, that's good. Let's see. Here's the next one. Hoping to awe her on the elevator. I wonder if this guy is like an evangelical pastor. Okay.
Well, this particular guy, he writes very kind of deflating. He's a kind of a Rodney Dangerfield making fun of himself kind of a thing. So.
Oh, okay. Hoping to awe her on the elevator. I feel like I should read it like hoping to awe her on the elevator. He said. That's Chopin playing. It's Handel's Sarabande, she snapped. He got off on the next floor.
Later, she checked on the internet. It was Chopin! She never rode that elevator again without wincing and thinking of him.
That's good. Oh. Some of these, by the way, don't take up 140 characters.
No,
some of them are like this one. She was his perfect kind of dangerous.
They were a perfect fit. Too perfect. Even comfortable. Then he met a domestic maternal girl who terrified him. He proposed.
Good.
Thanks.
Yeah, that's good. These are, you know, haiku stories. These are great.
This next one is a little dark. Takes a dark turn.
Jim took golf clubs to tennis, scuba gear to field hockey, ice skates to polo. My son marches to a different drummer, his mother beamed.
At night, Jim wept in secret. I just want to fit in and have friends. The drummer laughed harshly. You'll do as I say.
Yikes. Okay. Let's see.
Two more to go. So these are both one of them is a little dark but silly, and then the last one is one of the earliest ones. This goes all the way back to the very beginning, the very, very early days of Very Short Sequel, when I was only doing Very Short Stories, the original guy that inspired me. So
okay, let's see. Help, I'm being held against my will. They won't feed me unless I write these little stories. Not sure how long I can go on, dot, dot, dot.
Please ignore that last story. It was a rough draft, not meant for publication. I'm fine. Go about your business. Please, go!
And here is the last one.
Yes, the last one.
Batman and Robin burst in seconds after Joker left. Batman grabbed Robin's bat tweet and smashed it. Stop tweeting everything we're doing.
Okay. And here comes a little bit of Twitter humor.
Okay.
Holy cyber stalking, Batman, Robin cried. You mean the whole time that we were following the Joker, he was following us?
Very good.
Thank you. Yes.
That's what that right there is what you call your basic irony is what that is. So, well, anyway, where, you know, just so people can refresh. See, that was also kind of internet humor right there.
Yes.
That was a like a pun and stuff. Where can people go to read your very short sequels?
They can go to Very Short Sequel. It's Twitter/Very Short Sequel. And so what I do is I write my own story or reply, and then I retweet the other person. So if you start at the top and just read down, you will read, for instance, right now, you'll read a story by a guy named Jeff Provine, and then after that, you'll read my reply. But then there will be a story from a small fiction, and then my reply, and so on.
Okay.
So that's how it works. By the way, I just have to tell you, I got a text from my lady Suze. She says, "Your 13-year-old's description of your show: two dorks cracking up at their own jokes."
Well, that's pretty good,
but
you know.
Very funny jokes, especially to dorks.
That's right, you know, and someday, you know, just tell your 13-year-old, or I should say your 13-year-old is listening in, you are a larval dork, and someday you'll be doing this yourself, so just, you know.
If you're lucky.
Have some respect. So, all right, well, we are... Rats, we're running out of time. Do you have, can you just grab off of your Twitter feed? Can you just grab your latest very short sequel, or the story in your very latest very short sequel?
I could do that. Okay. So Jeff Provine's latest story goes, "Our timeline is just like yours, except we use tooth powder instead of toothpaste." Weird. Oh, and the monthly alien bug invasion. So here's the sequel.
Okay.
Oh. Oh, what? Oh, nothing. I was just thinking about a problem we used to have. How our temporal engineers fixed it.
That's pretty sly. I want to thank you so much for being on the show today, Deacon Steve Gordonis. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. Our producer was Danny Hett, and I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we'll be back tomorrow with Mr. Doug O'Brien. Until then, have a grand evening. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.